This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. For much of the 20th century, the narrative of South Sudan has been defined by violence. Nuol Tong was born in the crossfire of a bloody civil war. He says he is part of a generation that never knew peace. But when he tells you about South Sudan, Nuol is quick to remind you that his country is much more than a battlefield. Since the war, Nuol has made his way from South Sudan to North Carolina, and his home country is where much of his work is deeply rooted. Nuol Tong is a writer and a senior at Duke University and my guest today on The State of Things. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Tell us about where you're from now in southern Sudan.
I'm from a small village called Ayet. It's in Barghazar region. What used to be Barghazar region, one of the three regions of South Sudan, but now is divided into several states. And so my state is called Warap. And I'm about 30 miles away from Abyei, the contested region between South Sudan and the Sudan. Yeah, so it's a tiny village, farming village.
And tell us about growing up those first 5 years as you were growing up in that village and what life was like.
As a child, life was, because the war was already happening, was actually, this is the 90s, so the war was at its height of intensity. The government, the Northern Sudanese government had escalated the war, and it was using all kind of weapons, gunships and airstrikes. And our village being near Abyei and the northern border was always a target. And so my life was basically spent in the rainy season in the village, farming and fishing, and in the dry season in the forest where we hid for months, because in the dry season the rivers dried up and the Arab militia could easily cross into the villages and terrorize people. Yeah, so that was it. So it was, we would be just having fun the rainy season, fishing, chasing dragonflies in the fields, trying to bring our parents water in the fields, or trying to guard the crop from birds and stuff like that. And in the dry season, we would be in the forest and trying to chase the monkeys and build huts and, you know, name caves and stuff like that. So it was mostly fun, because I think I did understand the larger implications of what was happening. Of course, the war was there and the running was there, but it was the norm. So in many ways, I was able to have some fun as a child.
It's interesting to think about that mm-hmm. this would be an adventure for you, the kind of summer adventure to go off into the forest mm-hmm. when of course it's a time of great peril for yeah. And your father had an elevated position, did he not, and that made him a target and your family a target? Am I right about that?
My father is the chief of my village, and the Dinka political structure, we don't have a centralized government, so the Dinka people, the largest ethnic group in the Sudan, is a very egalitarian society. So there are thousands of small villages that are ruled and run by chiefs and their sub-chiefs. So my dad was a chief, and throughout the war, he was helping out, trying to contact, working, you know, with NGOs to bring in some food, medical supplies, and a semblance of education, really. But in the early, late mid-90s, in 1994, 1996, the war took a personal turn when a general in the rebel group defected to the north and returned to our area, recruiting chiefs, so that, because if chiefs joined him, then other young people would join. And of all the chiefs in our county, my father refused to join this guy, and so he was arrested, and for 6 months he was sentenced to death. And through my mother's attempts and the help of other people, he was able to escape. And so the general basically issued a decree to kill him and to kill my mother. So that's how the war became really personal, and that's when its danger became evident to me, because then we had to leave. Our farms were burned down, our cattle was taken away by the general and his army, and that's why we left, really.
And where did you go first?
For the first 6 months, we moved around. We, for example, stayed for about 3 months in the Sud. The Sud is the largest wetland, I think, in Africa. And it's huge, and it's basically it's just a big swamp, and there are villages and communities on this floating vegetation. And so we were there for 3 months, and it was rough because our village was considered the town, and the villages on the suit were really the villages. And so the lifestyle there was different. You had a lot of fish. There was no salt, which is not fun. So we were there for about 3 months, and eventually we returned to the village, and then some things happened, and Dad decided we should leave the country completely to the north.
A lot of fish, no salt, meaning you can't preserve the fish?
In the village, there's no salt.
Yeah.
And so people, because salt, interestingly, came from the north, and northern merchants brought the salt, but it never reached the villages in the swamp. And so the eight fish, it's traditional there without salt. And growing up, I was used to salt. Uh-huh. So it was. I'm remembering this because it was very distinct. It's those sort of details, I think, that always bring up the larger memories. But I remember that I struggled the first few days eating the fish without salt. Yeah.
And what about the with their cultural differences? I mean, during this time of great displacement, people are moving in big numbers. And when they move into new places, it can often cause conflict.
Yeah, of course. Movement in South Sudan was the norm as well, because before I was born, my three older brothers had been sent away by Dad, two to Kakuma and one to Northern Sudan. And so there was always somebody absent, and there was always somebody new that is not from your area. And you always had to contend with them. And so moving into the swamp areas was, of course, a challenge because we were not used to lifestyle and people there, really, because it's a village on a floating vegetation. Mm. So the life is very precarious, and there are certain practices that people had to observe that we didn't really pay attention to. So there was always that contention. But I think in wartime, you really learn how to live within borders. And that's something that people don't understand, is that borders become your ways of survival, boundaries, trying to understand and observe them. And that is always a challenge, whether you're in the swamp, villages, or in the refugee camps. There are always borders. Because I remember even in northern Sudan, I can talk about how the two towns were separated, right? The affluent Arab suburb and the refugee camp of tents. There was a highway that separated the two. And you had to learn really intuitively how to observe that border, that highway, because it was what really saved your life or could just undo it.
Well, you discovered a border in northern Sudan when you tried to go to school, right?
Of course, there was that. There are cultural borders as well. And so in Khartoum, for instance, I think this is a longer story, but in Khartoum, for instance, I was unable to attend the school, the local school, precisely.
And how old? Give us an idea how old you were.
I was around nine.
Okay.
Yeah, and we moved to northern Sudan when I was six, right? So after a year after the attack on the village and on me personally, we moved to northern Sudan. And so 4 years or 3 years later, I had pretty much learned Arabic, made some friends. And I recall that I would wait for my friends to come back from the primary school to play soccer. And it was a very lonely time. You wake up early in the morning and you watch your friends in their nice uniforms marching to school. And so I asked them if I could come to the school with them. And they were like, yes, of course, this is a public school. Of course, there are certain requirements like uniform and school supplies. But in terms of tuition, it's public school and you should be able to come. We were very innocent, and so I worked for a year washing cars, babysitting, delivering groceries, doing all kind of things. And I did it all in secret because somehow I knew Mom wouldn't approve. And I purchased, the school bag and the school supplies. And that morning with my friends, I went to the school. And I remember that before the assembly at 8:15, we were just, plotting how we were going to, run the school, because we had a little gang of soccer players and we had our teams, made up. And it was fun. And I never felt so alive or so included in northern Sudan until then. And so the assembly started at 8:15. And it went well. I learned some Quranic verses that were read in the assembly. I learned the national anthem of Sudan by heart. My friends taught me what I needed to learn, basically, to be there. And I was pretty much ready to undertake any exam, anything, just to be part of that school. But on our way to the classrooms, I think around 8:45, I was stopped by a teacher and asked to see the headmaster, and I did, and I was practically told that I couldn't go there because I didn't have the documents that demonstrated I was a Sudanese. And for me, that was the first time I felt I had to, in many ways, I had to really define myself. I was born into a royal family. I knew who I was. I knew the history of my family, my lineage, and where I came from. And so who I am was never a question. It was never questioned. And so that was a boundary that wasn't really written, but it was there. And I didn't know it because I was too young. And so there are all kind of boundaries like that. Some are visible, and hence you can avoid them or go around them. But some are invisible, and they always open up really a lot of pain, but also a lot of openings into a lot of understanding, a lot of self-knowledge, a lot of growth. And so that experience, if it really exemplifies all the different boundaries that a lot of refugees had to contend with, and the hardest boundaries were those that they did not know.
We will talk more about the boundaries that Neul Tong crossed, both geographic and psychological, when our conversation continues on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, talking with Neul Tong. Neul is a writer and a senior at Duke University. We're talking about your time in Khartoum when you were told you were all set to go to school and learned that you couldn't go because you didn't have the proper credentials. And there was much more to this. I mean, there was a very deep racial element. This is part of the what was behind the Civil War, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it was more to it than that. Maybe you can explain some of the dynamics between the North and the South without going into the entire complicated history of the Civil War that was also behind this rejection that you received.
Mm-hmm. For example, in the assembly, when we were standing reciting some Quranic verses and our national anthem, I noticed I was the only black African in the assembly. And it didn't... Because I was too naive, I felt it was a privilege, really, to be among, to be the only African there. But really what that meant, it really just showed how racially stratified Sudan is, and that the racial discrimination, the racial stratification is at the heart of the Sudanese Civil War. And it goes back before the colonial era even, because Sudan as a country did not exist until the Ottoman and the British came, and before then it was a bunch of sultanates that basically raided the South, where there was no centralized government. And so the South Sudanese were always considered the lower class, the slaves. And the word abd, which means a slave, is used like casually in Sudan, in northern Sudan, describes South Sudanese. And if you read any memoirs by South Sudanese, you find that word at the heart of it. So Sudan is a very racially stratified country, and race would be a defining feature. The interesting thing is this. In the north, those who subscribe to the Arab ethnicity are not Arab either. They are a mix of African and Nubian and Kushite tribes, and Arab, of course, are merchants that came throughout the previous centuries. But because of our geographical location, we are closer to Egypt, and also British colonized Sudan through Egypt, and we were part of Egypt until we became independent in the 50s. So that Arabic influence in terms of language, in terms of culture, is very much alive. And so the religion of Islam, the Islamic faith, for example, assumes this ethnic kind of like character. So it's not just a faith, it's an Arabic faith. And those who subscribe to Islam automatically you must subscribe to Arabism as an ideology. And so that is at the heart of the Civil War, really.
Yeah, it's very complicated because really language and religion are the real markers. Ethnicity is much more complicated than that. And, of course, the colonial powers, both the British and then later now the Chinese, are using those ethnic tensions to their advantage when it comes to the resources of that place, most of the oil being located in the south.
Yeah, and then you have then Darfur. The reason Darfur is a genocide is exactly that. Although the Darfurians were part of the north during the war because of the Islamic element of the war, now the war is turned against them. They are Muslim enough, but they are not Arab enough to be included in the political, you know, power. And it's interesting. So, but this is a reduction as well. Because all of these ethnicities, all of this diversity is not necessarily something that is inherently, you know, problematic. It's how the politicians use it, right? So every politician would see what will galvanize people ideologically to move them. And in this, we're in the South. Like, Northern Sudan did not know anything about the South, what was happening there at all. Like, they did not know. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. I mean, you learned that when you went up.
Absolutely.
Talk about this thirst for education you have, and your stories about sort of reading before you could read. Tell us how important education was to you even before this school episode.
My father always said that if you had any education, he would have made a lot of difference, not just in our lives, but in the lives of many people in the country. And so both my parents are illiterate. They have never received any formal education. And so that was always a dream that never happened, a dream that we sort of inherited, or a loss that we inherited from our parents. So we were always, my parents always instilled that desire in us. And so when we came to Northern Sudan, for instance, there were a lot of things that we could have done. But my mom wanted us to go to school, but we couldn't afford the schools. And she knew better than I did that the public schools were not for us. Yeah, so there was that desire. But me, the desire for education came from my love for words and storytelling. I grew up on stories about my grandfathers, about my, you know, friends, grandparents. Like, I would move around, usually just listen to stories. And when I came to Northern Sudan, the Arabic language was fascinating. And I always wanted to be described as an eloquent person and to tell best stories. And so that's how it started. So I started to try to learn Arabic. And, of course, that was difficult. And I learned slowly from other people. Like, there was this imam who would read in the afternoon before the afternoon, like, prayer. He would sit under this utility pole and read a newspaper. And I would come slowly, and I'll just sit next to him, hear him read. And so he would be reading silently, and then when he sees me sitting next to him, he'll start read aloud, as if to me. And he would teach me a word or two, like austerity measures in the country. And I would go use them at my mom to describe situation at home. For example, instead of having, like, meat that night, we're going to have, let's say, soup. Are we having austerity measures here, Mom? Mom would be like, what are you talking about? Stuff like that. And so I would learn these big words that I use all the time.
Were you doing this in Arabic?
Yeah, in Arabic, well? Yeah.
And go ahead.
Yeah, so that's how it started. And then I started to collect books, just magazines that I didn't read. But I always wanted to describe about the smart kid, the kid who can tell stories, who can use the big words. That was the initial interest. But when I learned how to read, really, the interest... The books became really a different world. And I think for the first time, there was this secret that I had that I felt other people did not have, namely the love for reading. And I would read a book or a magazine and just to spend an hour in it, learning about something that's new, that's outside your purview. Just to read about Zinedine Zidane, who is this soccer player from France, like to read about him, about his life, just in a soccer magazine because you didn't have access to real stories, just magazines and fashion magazines. Just to get that diversion from your reality, to me, was something that I was addicted to it. I always sought that, anything to leave the realities that were surrounding me.
Well, that's fascinating when you think about your interest in borders, because in a sense that creates a border for you that you've done, and it puts you on the other side. Did you feel outcast? Did it set you apart from the people you grew up with?
Yeah, it did, but it was in a good way. People always taught me this. I was the dreamer. Like, I was never here. Like, they would say, can you come back? Because I'm always talking about things that weren't there. I knew a lot of information, like about things that nobody cared about. But also the love for words really made me interested in poetry. And I met this college student I spent only 6 months with her. But from her, I learned a lot about poetry, about storytelling. And I remember one Christmas, she had me write this poem that I read at the Christmas party. And it was at the church. My mom wasn't there because my mom was not a Christian then. I had to convert her, actually. That's a different story. But I remember reading the poem, and it was the first time I speak in public. And I was so nervous that I started to cry. And people thought I was moved by the poem, right, to tears. So they started to cry with me. And I was so embarrassed. So that day, I never come back home with my friends from the church. I come late. I don't want to be seen. I spent a week away from the soccer field because you're a boy. You don't want to be seen crying in public. Yeah, but so I come back. And I remember that when I came to the soccer field, my friends stopped and they were congratulating me. That was a good poem. And I remember that woman in the streets, refugee woman, would say, recite the poem, and I would recite it. And then mom heard about it. And mom did not speak Arabic well because the poem was written like in a formal Arabic. And so mom asked me one night to read her, recite her the poem. I did. And mom cried even though she didn't understand a single word. And to me, that became my persona, yeah, the poet, right? So every other Christmas, I would write something. At the weddings, I would be invited to, you know, introduce people, stuff like that. And that became my identity, right? The kid with the big words, the kid who tells good stories or who's eloquent.
And this was, I didn't get it, if it was an original poem. It was a poem you wrote?
It was original, but not really, because it was original in the sense that, I guess the images, because I was trying to describe, basically, like, I was just describing, I think it was informed mostly by that experience from the school,
right,
but also by other things, because the student who helped me, she was very political in the sense that her commitment to educating refugee youth was very political. So she's the one actually took me to the Sudanese National Museum, where I learned about the ancient history of Sudan. But also it's interesting because then Sudan wasn't just this, like, I was describe myself as from Ayet. Not from the south, but from Ayet. Ayet, the village, was my home, right? But now I was told this story that made the entire Sudan part of me. So the poem was basically describing that, the instability, right? Until when, children of south. That was the title of the poem, until when, right? We go home, until when we go to school, until when we can end this homelessness, facelessness, namelessness. It was a poem about that, basically. So the images were mine, but the language wasn't, because I was trying to be very pretentious. Use the biggest words possible. Like istighrar, which means adam istighrar, which means in Arabic, lack of stability. I didn't even know what that meant.
Right.
But I was trying to describe these things. So it was original, but it was also very attempt at being eloquent. So there was that aesthetic, artistic attention to skill or to craft.
Were you able to jam austerity program in there? I mean, it'd be neat if you did. No, I'm joking. You would have found a way.
I use words that were, like, for example, I use a word that the imam taught me. So the word that the imam taught me was, like, for example, Arabization, right? Imam actually has an interesting story. Before he became an imam, he was a soldier in the First Civil War. So he wasn't really this just religious figure. He was very unhappy with the reality of Sudanese politics, the way the South Sudanese were being treated. And that's why he was really open to having his son play with me. His son was the only Arab kid that ate in my house. Yeah. It was only his house that I was allowed to sit in the chair. In other Arab houses, I had to sit on the ground, even though my friends, my host, was sitting on a chair. So there's this, like, this guy who was really, really unhappy with the reality, but he was trying to help me. So I learned words like Arabization, Ta'rib Sudan, right? The Arabization of Sudan. I used that word in the poem, for instance.
Do you have a sense now, looking back? I mean, you talked about the fact that you cried for some reason. You think it was nerves. Other people were crying, perhaps out of sympathy. Your mother cried. She barely understood the language. Mm-hmm. It wasn't your native language. I'm thinking about all of the displacements inherent in this poem that are stitched together, and it creates yet a common human emotion.
Yeah.
Everybody cried. What do you think it was?
Perhaps maybe I mischaracterized why I cried. Because I was moved by the words, but I think I cried because I was nervous. But also, I was brought up in oral tradition. And when I read Arabic, when I read a poem in Arabic, I read it using that oral kind of tradition, upbringing. For instance, even when I was 5, in the villages, poems in South Sudan and stories, like new stories, are told to children as if to inscribe them on their memories. So if you're a poet, you have a new poem, you invite children and you tell them the poem, children memorize it, and children have the capacity to memorize the cadence, everything, the sound, the rhythm, the musicality of the poem. So we are told to memorize and then sing it aloud, travel around the village, right, singing the new poem or the new song. So I had that background. So when I read Arabic, there was something very sustenance about it in terms of how words themselves, a sound, moved me. So it wasn't just me reading, it was me really embodying in my voice the words that I was reading, even though in their foreignness. And I think my mom was more or less proud of what I had done, and she was being told by the woman, your son recited this beautiful poem. And she had no idea what it was about. So it was. I think that's why. And I don't know why other people cried, but I guess it could be that, yeah.
So tell us about your time in Cairo. You eventually went to Cairo.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that experience. You were hoping that things would be better there, right?
Yes, and to Cairo for us, we came to Cairo like all South Sudanese to seek asylum to the Western world. Like a lot of, because the UN had just opened an office there for resettlement, and so to Canada, Australia, the United States. So we came with high hopes to do that. We were also lucky in the sense that one of my brothers received an asylum from Kakuma to the United States, and so he sent us money to bribe our way to Cairo and to really live in a nice apartment in Cairo. Yeah, but soon enough, we learned those dreams were those just dreams. The process was quite complicated. So as a family, for example, the reason that our application did not work out is that you had to hire a case writer who would write your story or your case to the UN. And my mom, who had hired a poet in northern Sudan to really put our experience into a narrative form, or a narrative form which goes for 3 hours long. And so our story, our modern story, was really in a poem, 3 hour long poem. And so when we were looking to presenting our case, she basically thought that we're going to bring the case writer, she's going to sit there before him and recite the poem, and the guy would just write that, transcribe it, and give it to the UN people. The guy was like, nope, I just need $300 and I will have your story ready. Which means that he had a rubric. He could just invent whatever. Right. And mom was offended. So we never officially applied for that status. So we just stayed in Egypt. And for me, that's from my family perspective, or my family's reality in Egypt. For me, Egypt was a different thing. I met an amazing Catholic priest, one of whom really, really took interest in me. And he knew that I loved to read and I want to write. And so he hired an Egyptian librarian to get me any book I wanted. He couldn't put me in a boarding school, he said, but he could get me books. So I read books like philosophy, mostly theology and poetry. So I have this librarian who would travel around Cairo, like after looking for libraries and looking for books. Yeah, so that change, that was for me, was a big, in terms of my education, was a big foundation.
It's interesting because this is your entree into theology philosophy at a whole different form.
Absolutely. And I mean it was amazing how much I learned, even though I didn't understand a lot. Like for example, the first time I read Kant, I didn't understand what he was talking about. I don't understand even today.
Yeah, nobody does. But go ahead.
but in reading that's a spoke that a sutra, Nietzsche's book. It's just in Arabic, I think it's far more beautiful than it is in English. And so I memorized lines, and I was just interested, learning new words, learning new ways of thinking. But it also led me to meeting this professor. So I think after a couple of years of, you know, reading these books, I was invited along with 18 other refugees kids to participate in this writing workshop organized by an American professor called Brooke Comer at the American University in Cairo. And we wrote essays, and there was a contest. And I think what distinguished my writing from those of other refugee youth was that there was some philosophical stuff that I was that were influencing my writing. So Brook was quite impressed, and that connected me. So in many ways, if I hadn't met this priest, and if the interest in reading and trying to write hadn't been established by all these different encounters, I would have never met Brooke Comer. And so Egypt was great in that sense. But also in a larger context, Egypt, I have to be honest, wasn't necessarily a pleasant place for South Sudanese and for Sudanese in general. Egyptian society is quite racist, and there are stories that I could relate that are horrific. For example, in 2005, there was an incident. 2004, so refugees protested before the headquarters of the United Nations High Commission for Refugees, demanding why they were not being resettled. And the Egyptian show of force in cracking down the protest was brutal. I think 27 people died. There was no official investigation about that. That's an example. If you went to Egyptian hospitals, you'll find a lot of South Sudanese or a lot of African people just hurt for no reason. And so Egypt, in that sense, was a very horrible place. Also, the interesting thing is this. The Sudanese, the northern Sudanese, were also discriminated against. And here's the inversion of race, all right? So this northern Sudanese student or kids would come to church to pray. So they wouldn't go to pray in mosque. They would come to church, which was for South Sudanese, who were supposed to be Christian, to pray. And so here we were Sudanese really forced to unite as Sudanese. So that's an interesting thing about those kind of boundaries.
We will talk about those boundaries and your trip to the United States and what led you to Duke when our conversation with Newell Tong, a writer and senior at Duke University, continues after this short break. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Newell Tong is with me. He's a writer and a senior at Duke University by way of South Sudan, Northern Sudan, Cairo, and then California. Tell us about getting to California.
So the professor, the American professor who organized and ran the writing workshop, went to high school in Santa Ynez Valley in California, around Santa Barbara area. And after we became friends, she came back to the high school and somehow convinced them to offer me a scholarship to come there. It's a very expensive $1,000 scholarship. And so I come to the States with my funny English and a lot of philosophy books that I still have in Arabic. So I come to the boarding school, and the first year I spent with an American family so that I could get my bearing before I was a boarding student. California for me was... it was something I wasn't even planning, coming to America or to California in particular. And it was a pleasant surprise, but it was also very, very challenging because for the first time I had my own room. I had more than two pairs of underwear, more than two pairs of shoes. Yeah. There was certain privilege that came with it that I didn't know how to deal with. And there was certain things were as they were supposed to be, a sense that I never had. So there's a normalcy of privilege that was problematic. And so in California for the first few years, of course, I was trying very hard to do well academically, and I wasn't because of the English barrier or the language barrier. But then I had tutors and I caught up. But also the social and psychological and social adjustment is something that took me a long time to really come to terms with. Yeah.
You met Dave Eggers.
Yeah.
Who wrote What is the What, which is the story. Ostensibly, it's written as a memoir of one of the lost boys of Sudan. What was it like to meet him? How did you meet him?
In my junior year in high school, I was looking for something to do. I was supposed to go home because I hadn't been home since I was five when I left. And I was now able to talk with my dad because the peace agreement had been signed and South Sudan was on its way to become a country. So that summer didn't work out, going to South Sudan. So I emailed Dave and asked if I could come and intern at the Valentino Chagdeng Foundation, which is the foundation of the protagonist of What is the What, it builds the schools in South Sudan. So they were like, yeah, come in. So I came in. They put me in an apartment. And Dave is very interested in people, young people in particular. And so one day he just came by the office and said, let's have lunch. And so we walk down Mission Street of Valencia, and we had our lunch. He had fruit salad, which was a lunch, but I had a turkey sandwich. And we just start talking about my time in San Francisco, but also about literature, if I had liked What is the What. And I had liked What is the What, and we just talk about that. And he really, really became a friend instantly. And, you know, every time I would write something in high school, I would send it to him, and he would look at it, make comments. Like, he was very prompt. I was surprised.
One of the themes in that book is the sort of the story of the protagonist, which sounds to most Americans exotic, frightening, and brutal at times. And yet, when he comes here, it's quite clear that he finds an equally brutal, if not more brutal, kind of landscape that's different in many ways, but normal to Americans.
Yeah.
Did you find that here?
Yes. I mean, I think struggle or brutality has different dimensions. And even in South Sudan, the brutal nature of that reality was very physical in terms of, you know, bombing and running and all of that. In Northern Sudan, it was psychological, right? Having your identity questioned, your belonging to the particular country questioned. In Egypt, was about that. But in the United States, it's really this world that had never configured. It wasn't even like an opposite to my reality. I mean, the reality of Sudan was instability and all of that, but peace and stability wasn't the opposite of it, right? The logical opposite of it that I should have anticipated. This was an entire different game. And so there's a certain sense in which stability, in which privilege, in which being bestowed upon with resources can be a form of psychological brutality.
How so? Why?
For example, one of the challenges is how do you really embrace the blessings that you are given, right? What makes you unique to deserve the blessings? Because you grew up taking nothing for granted, and now you're not only given something, you're given an entire world of a condition that will change your life for good. I had no illusions. I knew that I'm here. Things are going to be different for now, for good. They're going to be drastically different. So why was it me? There were 18 or 19 of us who participated in the writing workshop. Why did Brooke befriend me? Why did this high school give me a scholarship without me demonstrating some kind of qualification? So trying to make myself worthy of the blessings of the resources was a brutality. So it makes you question your worth. But of course, that's, I think, something a lot of people struggle with. And so that was one. Another option is really in the little details. So you go to In-N-Out, which is this fast food restaurant, and you have, you know, on the menu 8 to 10 options, and you're asked to choose whatever you like. And I was used to that. So even in that very act of choice, like how much of it is your choice? Like who's paying for it? So all of these things, because you grew up depending on yourself, on what you are able to provide for yourself. Now you're depending on another person. And it made really being grateful difficult because it was just too much.
Your wrestling with those questions has led you to some deep insights about gratitude and about the nature of narrative, in particular these sort of heroic narratives that have come out of the kind of struggle that that you've experienced. Tell us more about that, about your ideas concerning gratitude.
The reason I was struggling being grateful in the way I thought I should have been had to do with how self-centered the whole thing was. It had to do with me. It had to be something about me that really warranted this show of compassion and affection, right? But if you think about it, at least the more I thought about it, the more I realized that it's just about me. And actually the me is more extended. It includes how the people feel about me and what is their investment in me. And actually there might not be a very simple explanation. It's because it's not a reward, right? It's something that these people are happy to do for me, and I don't deserve it. And to understand doesn't mean there's something lacking in me to be worthy of that. It just means that, okay, it's not new. There are a lot of things that you've had that you don't deserve, but you have had, you have them anyway. And I'm here. I'm in Santa Barbara, having a nice life, having an excellent education. I have to be grateful, but not just saying thank you. Mm-hmm. This gratitude means also that I have to, in some sense, be obligated to do the same to others. Mm-hmm. Precisely what enabled these people to help me is their having resources. And now I do have resources. So the foundation, for instance, in many ways was an expression of that, a way to relate that gratitude, a way to make sense of this gratitude that I have had. And in narrative, I think, as you were mentioning, the notion of gratitude, at least in the memoirs that we have, this isn't my issue even with What is the Word, this is my issue with other books about South Sudan or about those of us who have made it here. They tend to be very self-centered or centered around celebratory of the survivor, right? But the process, survivor is not just one act, it's a process. It's, in South Sudan, I would say your birth was an act of survivor, that you were born with, you know, bullets ringing, with the earth trembling with bombs, and here you are. Already, you were depending on others, right? Because it wasn't a normal circumstance. Your parents, for them to dare to conceive you, right, when this sky is raining with bullets, that is an act of survivor. It's an act of defiance against, really, death, against uncertainty, right? So you really can celebrate this survivor as your own. It has to be, your celebration is always in gratitude.
But think about the depth of what the meditation that you just described. Mm. I mean, it's certainly it's profound to notice that you didn't do it on your own, that nobody does, that no hero really, really survives without a lot of imams and priests and mothers and aunts along the way.
Perfect strangers.
And perfect strangers. And that you didn't deserve it.
Yep.
It's not a
and
reward, as you said.
Yep.
That's the key.
Yep.
The because if you're struggling with that internally, why am I here? Why did I survive? And you don't come to this question of gratitude, then the rationalization is, I earned it.
Yep.
And you will make stories
about
how you earned it and how everybody in your family deserves it and how those who want it from you.
And we have that politically, like the whole argument against, let's say, universal health care or government providing, helping others. Like welfare, right, isn't just a charity. It is an obligation. It is a reality that is affirmed by our very upbringing. We are not who we are because we were born with this authentic power, this thing, consciousness that we had determining everything. No, we are who we are because of our teachers, because of the road we traveled, because of the babysitter, right, the high school baby who came when your parents had to go to work. We are all because of this thing, or the walk we took in the mountains. We are all of these things. And these are not things that are from within us. They're outside as a contingent. So, and for people to really forget that because you have somehow made it to a position of some semblance of independence. Because, look, I'm here. I can provide for myself. I can easily really say that, look, I've made it. I can go to South Sudan. I have made it. I'm going to Duke University. I'm writing. I'm achieving my dreams. It's all, you see, it's because of my determination. But that's not the case. I mean, I know people who are way smarter, way gifted than me, but they're not doing the things that I'm doing precisely because of the extended nature of success.
And one of the things that has that you have accomplished with all of that help and because of your skill is that you are now a published writer. You had a story published in McSweeney's.
Yep.
I wonder if you tell us about the story, and I'd like you to read for us, and maybe you can set it up, tell us about the story in setting up this reading.
Yeah. The story is called The Bastard, and the notion of the bastard is always fascinating. By the bastard, I mean the illegitimate. It's also it's a story of gratitude in a sense, right? It's this illegitimate figure that has to fight for legitimacy all the time. And what I was trying to do in the story is really capture how we are all in Sudan are bastards of stability and peace, because peace is not a legitimate condition that we know. We just happen to be there. And peace, if it were a country and it had its own structure, would not recognize us. We have to claim it. And so it's a story about that. It's how this boy and his mother are trying to come to terms with that, are trying to reestablish old relationships. He's trying to meet his father, or at least find his father. But his father is a different person. And the father figure, I mean, the men in this story are all really destroyed by war. And they betray the woman or the mother. But their betrayal is not just man betraying woman. It's also what the war does to people. And peace itself is its own kind of war coming to terms with it. And that's what I was trying to do. So trying to catch the contemporary South Sudan and what we are right now, what we're doing, right, the insecurity of not having a legitimate claim to a particular throne, that is peace, that is having a country. We were born before the country. How do we make it our own, right? So that's the story. We're trying to capture that.
Would you read for us?
Yes, please. The trip from Panagam had taken 3 days. Two bus tickets at £200 each were beyond our means, so we paid a local merchant £50 and crouched on sacks of maize flour in the back of his rusted Honda pickup truck. The road was still under construction, full of potholes, and so narrow that you could nearly touch the mud thatch huts and thorny shrubs on either side. At one point, we had to flatten ourselves against the flour sacks to keep from getting scratched when the truck pulled over to let a group of Land Cruisers pass. They whizzed by like bullets, darkened windows shielding the faces of their drivers, government officials, and NGO directors. They left nothing but dust in their wake. In Juba, after trekking across 500 miles, almost the length of South Sudan, we found Jali Jal happily married with 3 children and not in the least pleased by our presence. After exchanging pleasantries, he adjusted himself in his chair, faced us directly, and confirmed the rumor spread by various relatives that what he and Mama had done on the grass-covered shores of the Lal River 15 years ago, never mind that it begat me, was our witch, a mistake. He wanted nothing to do with that, he said, and he would be grateful if we never contacted him again. Then he rose up, fixed his blue tie, buttoned his black suit, and disappeared through the square door of the new Kush restaurant. There was nothing more to say.
Mule Tong is a writer and a senior at Duke University. That is his story, The Bastard Bastards, that appeared in McSweeney's magazine. We only have a few seconds left, so it's a beautiful story.
Thank you.
Thank you for reading that. Mm-hmm. So what's next for you? You're a senior at Duke?
I'm a senior. My hope is to be a philosophy or literature professor, but before that I want to do an MFA in creative writing and try to give this a shot. So that's the plan.
Well, we plan to see lots more writing from you and hope to have you back. Good luck in everything.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Mule Tong, a writer and a senior at Duke University. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Nicole Campbell, Alex Granados, Laura Lee, and Sean Nguyen. Robin Copley is our technical director, Brent Wolf, the news director. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.